Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Gators Breakdown, because there's never a dull moment in Gator Nation.
The Gators Breakdown podcast is ready to go. I'm your host, David Waters, and you can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Fall camp will be starting this week. Finally, Gator Nation will get some on-field action for football. But before we do, I think we got to head off the field one more time, clear up some questions, clear a lot of things up that's going on off the field right now. Helping me do that is David Chauncey. David, man, you reached out to me about this. We know it's a hot button topic, but a couple off the field issues and topics this summer heading into football season, conference expansion, NIL. Look, conference expansion kind of just came out of nowhere. We knew it was going to eventually happen. But
ain't that the truth?
Days come, it blows up right in all of our faces. But man, thanks for hopping on Gators Breakdown. I know a lot of people have a lot of questions about these two topics, the future of college football. You were gracious enough to reach out to me and trying to get something going here. So welcome to Gators Breakdown.
Well, my pleasure to be on here, David. Enjoy the podcast and enjoy the YouTube channel regularly.
Awesome. So, first of all, we got to give a little bit of background info on you. It is Gators Breakdown, and you are a Gator. So let everybody know you're growing up, probably a Gator fan, going to games, going to college at UF, and then your profession as well.
Yeah, no, I've been a Gator fan my entire life. So ever since the youngest of ages, watching Florida football, watching, of course, the fun and gun in the 1990s with Steve Spurrier. All the way through, had the opportunity to go to University of Florida during a great stretch from 2006 to 2010. So saw a lot of championships, saw a lot of success on the field, and then ended up going to law school as well at the University of Florida. And so, at this point, being a double Gator, I am, when it comes to my fanhood, I'm a Gator through and through, bleed orange and blue in that respect. But my law firm, the type of work that we do, also we do a lot of labor and employment law, so representing businesses and individuals across the state of Florida, as well as we have an interesting niche in education law, representing a lot of higher education institutions across the state as well. So I put my allegiances for sports aside for some of those things, and try to guide clients in a lot of these issues that are even coming up that we'll begin to talk about here.
Yeah, Dave is an education, labor, and employment lawyer for Alexander, DeGantz, and Barnett Legal right here in Jacksonville. So hometown here. And, of course, UF College of Law graduate there. So, Dave, man, yeah, we got plenty to discuss here. But quickly, man, we got to talk some football. How excited are you, man? The camp starting this week. Gators won the East in 2020, 2021. More of a question mark heading into the season, man. But what you looking forward to as the Gators hit the field Friday?
Well, I mean, it's just good to have football back. It's good to be able to turn on the TV and see that both in the NFL and at college, everybody's starting back, and we don't have much longer to wait through the hot summer to get to some football. And it always is hot starting off those seasons in the swamp, but that's the way we like it. I think that we have a team that has a lot of potential. I know that Georgia seems to be the favorite upcoming this year in the East. But, you know, we have a lot of talent. We have a lot returning on the defensive line. We have a defense that needs to improve, but the pieces are there. And so hopefully the coaching can be there as well to make that happen. And then, you know, on the offensive side, we need to protect whoever is quarterback. But, you know, if you got Emory Jones back there, you know, he's somebody that could, as we'll talk about soon with some of the name, image, and likeness stuff, I mean, he could have a huge year. He could blow up. He could be the type of guy that is able to be special. He's got some weapons. I know we, of course, lost a lot, both with losing Kadarius Toney and, of course, Pitts and some of the weapons that are around are Trayvon Grimes. But, you know, Dan Mullen, one thing you can say about him in the operation is that they know how to develop players and they know how to put guys in the right situations and they know how to make sure that that they're getting the most out of every single player. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to it. And it would not surprise me to see us have a good year, see UF end up in a situation where they're competing for a championship.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I did pick Georgia to win the East, but like I said, I'm not going to be surprised if Florida wins the East. I don't think that gap, you know, talent-wise, the gap may be large, but once you factor in everything, Dan Mullen's coaching, Dan Mullen developing, I think it shrinks that gap just a bit. Florida, I think, is in prime position to at least surprise some people in 2021, not take that far drop off.
Yeah, and I'll say this, the swamp will be rocking there for that Alabama game. You know, that'll be the truth. And so, you know, we'll see what happens there. And a lot of this when they come into seasons. And I'll tell you this, Dave, when I was at the University of Florida, I did some sports writing for the Alligator at the time. And so have some background in sports media in that way. I actually used to cover the track and field beat writer position for the Alligator and did some other sports. And so got the opportunity to even cover football a little bit back then. So every year you're going to go into these college football seasons and you're going to see the known quantities, especially at quarterback, being the teams that a lot of the media are going to choose. And so this year you have JT Daniels, of course, coming in. And so, yeah, he's a known quantity in some respect, while you have a lot of other teams that don't have a known quantity coming back at the most important position on the field. So, you know, Georgia's going to get that edge up front. Right now with what people are saying, of course, with a lot of the talent that they return, but you know, don't be surprised if we give them a real run for their money this year.
Yeah, should be fun either way. Dave, before we move on from football and get into conference alignment expansion and NIL, just your general thoughts on Dan Mullen overall. I know you said you like what he's been able to do with the quarterback position, but since he was hired at Florida from 2018 to now, maybe even the future, what's your thought on Dan Mullen?
I think Dan's done a good job. You know, I think people forget very easily how bad we were watching offense here at the University of Florida for several years, going back to of course during the Muschamp days and then into the McElwain era. And so, you know, the type of product that we saw last year, even if we wasn't up to standards on the defensive side of the ball, and across college football. Yeah, things were struggling on the defensive side of the ball, but to see the type of offense that he put together with Kyle Trask and being able to develop him and even develop, you know, Kadarius Toney the year before, it goes from being somebody that people were questioning whether he was even going to play play football during the COVID year to being a first round pick. And so Kyle Pitts, of course, emerged as well, but I mean, that's coaching a lot of it as well, and being able to mold those players into the guys that can be playmakers on the field. And so, you know, I remember being in the swamp for some games where we were struggling to put a field goal up on the board. We were struggling to get in the end zone or even come close to the end zone. And some of the ugliest games that we've seen at Florida Field in a long time. And so what Dan's done with the program is he's a steady hand on the offensive side of the ball, and he's somebody who has gotten results and some of the best results that there is in college football. Are there places that he can get better? I'm sure. There's places that we all can get better in where we're at, especially I know that there's constant talk about recruiting and that side of things. But you know what? You know, it's been fun in the swamp. It's been entertaining. And so I'm hoping that he can continue to grow and continue to take those steps, make those tough decisions, and we can get to a point where we're back to consistently winning championships.
Yeah, I think most of the thought is, you know, coming from 2018 to now, it is a look, Florida football is definitely a lot more fun with Dan Mullen on the sideline right now compared to what it was before. Maybe, you know, now maybe time to take that next step, but the, and you know, so close. You know, we've tasted, you know, right outside of the playoff, being in the top 10, so close that you see it right there. And I think a lot of the critique comes from so close. Now we just still have some questions on what the ceiling can be going into year four. So, you know, we'll see where it ends up. But I think for right now, Mullen's the right guy leading the charge. Florida football's fun again. And maybe some changes along the way. You know, coaches have to learn and adapt along the way. And I think that's what we'll see from Mullen moving forward. So, all right, Dave, let's get into the meat of the episode here. And look, Jeff Bishop from Gators Breakdown Plus, for a lot of the emails I send out there, I always ask for topics that they want to discuss. And this was perfect. You had sent the message before. I looked, man, I replied to Jeff. I was like, perfect timing, because he asked a question. I hope you do a future podcast soon about this realignment business. In my opinion, the Power Five will morph into the 32, 48 teams, maybe two conferences. I see teams dropping football, going to lower divisions. While this does not affect the Gators, it affects the sport. Transfer portal, NIL, conference realignment, this will not be the college football of the past. And I replied with, I said, look, I got it lined up already. I'm going to bring on Dave Chauncey, and we're going to discuss this. So it was perfect timing. There are a lot of questions out there. Dave, and let's start with realignment. I think that's, you know, the hot button topic right now. Like I said, going back to SEC media days. And look, Oklahoma, Texas, that came out SEC Media Day week already now, has been announced as members of the SEC, will not start till 2025. So a lot of questions going on with this are, 2025 is the date. That's the one that's been thrown out there. Is there any chance this can be done before then? And look, it's a slippery slope. We have seen ESPN called out by the Big 12. The Big 12 is going to stand strong as long as possible here. Now we've heard recent rumors of them and the Pac-12 maybe getting together. And look, this is all being driven by money, TV money specifically. So I'm going to ask you, here's the hot button topics, of course, along with realignment. Date, time, when it can happen, and this whole grant of rights for TV and how that plays into the timeline and if it can be adjusted.
Yeah, so I mean, the grant of rights are the biggest thing that is – in many ways going to hold up and is driving a lot of the decisions that are being made. And so kind of what a grant of rights is, even to explain that, is the schools have rights to the content that they're creating. So they, you know, in whatever type of situation that they are engaging in, the schools own a lot of the rights to the content that's being created. So into that intellectual property in many ways. And so when they are signing a grant of rights, they're giving over the rights that they have to their content, to their intellectual property, to the television rights of being able to broadcast their games to a conference, to a group of individuals and to a group of peer schools. And so at that point, the conference has then taken the rights to then market that and be able to market that to the different television potential partners that are out there. It's similar to if you were to write a book, Dave, and you are going to sign a contract with a publicist, with a publisher, and be able to say, well, in order for me to properly be able to get the most out of this book, I'm going to sign over rights to the publisher. Publisher is going to make some money off of this as well, but they're going to be able to market your book better to the general public. And so that's sort of how the grant of rights work. And it's a contract. It's a contract like any contract that any of us would sign and get into. But contracts are also something that are going to be rock solid if you have good attorneys that are there. And so you're not going to have quite the opportunity just to get out of them whenever you want, which is why I think a lot of people were surprised at the University of Texas and with the University of Oklahoma, taking action right now while their grant of rights were extended until 2025. So could the grant of rights, is there a way to get out of that? Like most contracts, there's always a way to get out of it. You just have to pay a certain amount of money to get out of it. So whatever that is within that grant of rights contract that Texas and Oklahoma would have signed over to the Big 12 at that point, you know, that is a number I've seen somewhere in the $75 million range per school. That would be the number that it would take to get out. But what you see regularly is the relationship no longer makes sense. We saw this with Maryland and when they moved to the Big Ten after wanting to lead the ACC, is the relationship no longer makes sense. Both parties want to move on, similar to what you would see with a lot of partnership splits, marriage splits all the way down. And so as a result, you see them negotiate a buyout. And so they may not wait the full period of time because the Big 12 may want to move on. The Big 12 may want to take the steps that they need to reassure their television partners and try to make sure that they have their house in order. And so they may say, well, let's negotiate something less. We're willing to take less to kind of move on, get things going. And so that's what you see. And so is there a chance that that could happen? Yeah, there definitely is a chance. The University of Texas is has been consistently one of the, if not the top earning program in college sports. So they have the money and a lot of the connections to make something like that happen. Oklahoma as well as one of the top earners. And so they could certainly take those steps to get out early. They're going to say all the right things up front, at least to make sure that they're saying the right things, that they're going to abide by the contract that they signed. But they could certainly take those steps, or they could pay the buyout. That's also something that could happen. So that's the ways that you'll see things progress quicker. And we'll see if they do want to take those steps to get into the SEC sooner rather than later. But I would expect that there'd be some sort of middle of the road type of discussion where, well, they'll have some sort of deal that comes about where they're not there till 2025, but they may not be there in fall 2022 either.
Dave, so why would a school like Texas and Oklahoma, to an extent, why would they even agree to a grant of rights? Like, you would think they'd be able to handle that end of it, you know, and not be hamstrung by the Big 12. Because, you know, Texas, I mean, that is, as you said, that is a brand. They could pretty much, I mean, look, they have their own network. The only school right out there that has their own network. So, they can pretty much call the shots for the Big 12. And in a way, that's kind of what's happening here. So why would a school like Texas even agree to a grant of rights in the first place?
So the grant of rights, and there's different tiers of the grant of rights. So the difference between what Texas is getting into at the SEC currently and what they've done at the Big 12 is they actually controlled that Longhorn network, right? They controlled that tier of rights and most of the games that were not being picked up by Fox or not being picked up by ESPN. They controlled those rights to those games. And so so why would they do that? It's really to pool the resources, say, for the University of Texas. And there was discussion of the University of Texas thinking about going independent for many years. And that's what independent schools did previous to when we've seen this big move of of independent schools wanting to join conferences. It's because you can sell yourself and say, well, here's what the University of Texas, Oklahoma together are going to be able to provide with their other partners in the Big 12. Here are the games that you'll be able to choose from. And so, you know, in a time where the University of Texas may not be as good on the field, being able to pull their resources, be able to grant that rights over to the conference say, you're going to get the best game Fox, or you're going to get the best game ABC, ESPN. There's potentially more money. And it's really what it comes down to. It's dollars and cents. That's what it comes down to it in those situations. But there are programs. I mean, Notre Dame, of course, shows that they can do it year in and year out and keep NBC as a broadcast partner. Texas is a potential brand that could have done something like that. And there are probably a handful of other brands that could do that as well. but it's just a lot more difficult. So that's why you don't see it as much with the independent schools. And if you remember back 30, 35 years ago, there were a lot of independent football schools, right? Yeah. That were signing contracts with TV partners. And all of this stems from a Supreme Court case. So all of this stems from the University of Oklahoma and the University of Georgia filing a lawsuit against the NCAA, which used to control all of the grant of rights for all of their schools. And that was up until the mid-80s. And then when ESPN and a lot of the change of cable and how cable was emerging in college football, the University of Oklahoma said, we don't want the NCAA to control our television rights. And so they filed a lawsuit, which Georgia ended up filing a lawsuit as well, saying, you know, we want to control our own rights. And so when that case, of course, case hit in the mid 80s, that's what set off the first set of realignment that we saw in around 1990 in the late 80s, early 90s, where you saw, you know, the Southwest Conference end up falling apart, the creation of the Big 12. But also seeing teams added like Arkansas and South Carolina to the SEC, seeing Florida State, Miami, different independent schools that had played independent football, even though they had been members of conferences for other reasons, join conferences like the ACC and the Big East. And so controlling those rights and then being able to market those rights really set off this whole thing from the beginning. And so we're just entering into another step of that, and we've seen it on several realignments. The one that we had 10 years ago, when Texas had threatened to leave Dakota the Pac, yep. 10 at that time. And so the idea is whatever makes the most dollars and cents they're going to do. And Texas has looked at what they're doing, whether it is the idea of being able to schedule teams, whether it's the idea of the playoff that's coming, the potential expansion of the playoff that's coming up. And what makes the most sense for their program moving forward as an entire school. And they see the stability of the SEC as being one that makes sense in comparison to what they have with the Big 12 or what they could do as an independent, and being able to give their grant of rights for all that television to the SEC to then combine with the Floridas and the Georgias and the Alabamas to then sell that for even more than they could get if they were just alone.
Dave, so that kind of does bleed into, okay, what does it mean for Florida? You know, Texas, Oklahoma come into the SEC. Of course, it means a harder schedule when you do play those teams. You mentioned the dollars and cents side of it. You know, in the end, adding two more teams off the field, on the field, this will have an effect on Florida.
Of course. I mean, it'll have an effect on each and every one of the SEC schools. But, you know, I think that, you know, we saw that the vote from the SEC came back as a 14-0 vote, and that Texas A&M sort of was dragged potentially into voting for that as well. But I think for the University of Florida, long term, it means stability. It means the ability to have a program that's in the premier league of college football. It means, of course, more television revenues that could be coming about as well. It means more filled stands. I think that something that I've heard from the University of Texas is that they had a big concern about their schedule, and the Big 12 bringing in the Kansas States and the Iowa States, even though they've done well in football in the last couple of years, and some of those programs don't bring people into the stadium. And so a good thing for Florida and for a lot of the schools in the SEC will be the ability to have more marquee games that attract people to wanting to go to games and go to the stadium and actually be there in person for the environment and all the pageantry and tradition that comes with college football. And so all those things, as well as the academic side of things. And you have to remember that all these college presidents are also thinking a lot about the academics and about their peer institutions. And the University of Texas is a highly regarded university, just as University of Florida is. I mean, if you look at things like the AAU, which is an elite group of universities that are associated with each other for research purposes, Previously in the SEC, there had been Vanderbilt, University of Florida, Texas A&M, Missouri, and University of Texas will be the next member. So that is definitely a part of it, and why that impacted the decision making of probably a lot of the university of presidents. But overall, it just creates more stability for the SEC and being a potential leader moving forward.
All right. So of course, domino effect here. Status of other conferences have to come into play. What are those conferences and schools thinking, doing right now? Earlier this week, FSU and Clemson was reported to have interest in joining the SEC. I questioned a source on that one, but it was out there. The OU Texas announcement, first of all, where it happened at SEC Media Days, that was not by accident. that come out on purpose so it would get in front of all the eyeballs that it possibly could. And then, set off dominoes, or it had to set off dominoes in other conferences and them trying to figure out their future. As I mentioned earlier, the Big 12 and Pac-12 has been reported. They're going to discuss maybe some kind of merger or scheduling alliance where they could boost their brands, boost their conferences. But we've also heard the same for the Big 10 and the Pac-12. So now you're going to have a lot of infighting among these conferences of trying to figure out who to poach, who to get, who to schedule. I think my question now is, what is the timeline in all this? Because now if the Big 12 wants to do anything or can do anything, what does that mean for the grant of rights contract in 2025? And, my thing is, if they go ahead and make a decision, as you kind of said, but if they make a decision with the Big 10 or the Pac-12, I think that would have to speed up the timeline as well.
Yeah. Holding their conference together is going to be difficult. And a big part, something I didn't mention with those grant of rights, is typically there is a clause from the television side of things that if they lose a certain amount of teams, that the grant of rights contract is then voidable. And it's been reported that once four programs were to leave the Big 12, that then the agreement is no longer valid, and then the television partner can step back and say, we're not paying this type of money for this conference, because this wasn't the conference that we agreed to at that point.
And Dave, before you go further on that thought, if I was ESPN or Fox, I'd be like, all right, if Oklahoma and Texas leave, all right, it didn't even have to be four teams. If those two leave, we're done.
Right. And so that's why even a lot of those within the industry were thinking that there could be some movement as these grant of rights ended. And one of because the Pac-12 as well, their grant of rights is ending here in 2024. The Big Ten's grant of rights is ending in 2023 with Fox. And so there was a lot of discussion about what was going to happen and whether there would be moves that were made. I just think that people weren't expecting it to come this quickly,
right,
from Texas and Oklahoma, although those were always the two schools that had the most sway in being able to sort of set this domino effect into motion. And so what we're looking at is conferences are going to have to make decisions on what makes the most sense for them moving forward and what will actually add to their conference. And what we saw 10 years ago was this cable network craze. And so we saw the creation of the SEC network. We've seen the creation of the Big Ten network and wanting to add eyeballs to those networks. And so that was kind of the driving force of what was occurring back in 2010, 2011, 2012. In the additions of, say, for the SEC was Missouri and Texas A&M. But moving forward, cable has struggled, as is well known by those even who don't follow this very closely. And so you're seeing a big change in the way that these college administrators are making decisions, especially at this high of a level, as it's not about those television networks quite as much anymore. It's really about creating the brands that are going to match up that a television executive who is going to be broadcasting a game live is going to be able to sell their advertisements during that game for as much money as possible. So the cable networks, even though the SEC was the most successful, the SEC network is the most successful cable network launching in the history of cable because of the passion of SEC fans. You haven't seen that necessarily with the Pac-12. You haven't seen that with the ACC. The Big Ten as well has had a very successful network. But the amount that a lot of these cable providers are willing to pay to add these networks is not quite where it was a few years ago and where people thought it could go, you know, with a lot of the other market forces that are going on. So, you know, they're thinking about what brands can we add to our conference, both academically, but specifically for football, right? Football is the driving force of all this. Academics are a driving force of this. The rest of the sports are not driving forces of this. And what brands could we potentially add to make sure that we are putting ourselves in the best position to negotiate with ESPN, ABC, with Fox, with CBS, with NBC to get the most money for all of our members.
Dave, one last thought for expansion realignment before we go into the NIL. Of course, money is the driving force here, but it's not the only factor in my mind or how I see it. You know, is this future realignment a indication of confidence in the NCAA? We've seen that wane in the last few years. And now, I mean, a lot of people are really asking the serious question. Does the SEC, does these big schools out there really need the NCAA? And I think the NCAA or SEC is kind of tired of dealing with the NCAA as far as kind of how they hamstring these big time programs and as far as major college football goes. So who knows the future of the college football playoff right now? That's in play here as well, I think. But I think these big time programs are just kind of sick of the NCAA and their ways. And look, we've seen the NCAA come out and say, look, we do need to change. Things need to change. But I mean, right now, with these big moves here in adding Texas and Oklahoma, you can see where, you know, it is a conference that maybe can just pull away from the NCAA and handle things themselves.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big piece of this is the NCAA has seen its influence wane over the last 40 years considerably. And so you're in a situation where it was just this past week, I believe, that Mark Emmert announced that there would be some constitutional convention of the NCAA. And they've been sitting on their hands in many respects because they don't know what influence they have. And they certainly don't have the influence that they once did. You know, a big part of this is that the amount of money being made by these large programs in many ways is beginning to create their influence in a way that has never been for a lot of these individual programs and these conferences. And once these conferences, as we talked about with the television side of things, once these conferences own the rights to their television deals and not the NCAA, it put a lot of the power into the conferences themselves. And so the conferences then are the ones that are signing these massive deals. There is nothing like college sports in American sports, right? I mean, it is about as organic of a creation as has come about. And so, you know, all these programs looking to jockey and figure out, you know, what makes the most sense, what was most rational for them to take steps. You know, those things have escalated to a point now as the money got bigger. College coaching salaries, I saw recently that it was about 20 states, number one employee money-wise for salary purposes is a college football coach. And so you've seen the escalation of all this occur. And so the NCAA is in a situation where you have these big programs that are making a lot of money that are associated with one another, big schools that want to take steps, that wanted to do things, say, with educational stipends that other members of the NCAA did not want to do because they're small schools. And what people have to realize, a big part of this is the NCAA represents all of these schools. Mm-hmm. So Division I, Division II, Division III, and your local school, private school in your city that has a small baseball stadium, a small basketball arena that they care about their sports, but they don't have the type of money that's flowing in that you would see, of course, in the SEC or the Big Ten. And so their interests are very different, and they're not making a ton of money. In fact, they're potentially losing money off of their sports programs, just like the big programs are losing money off of a lot of their non-revenue sports, and their non-revenue sports are pretty much everything outside of football basketball, and in some schools have, you know, a baseball program that makes them some money, or a gymnastics program that might make them some money, but the interests are very different. And so the NCAA is in a at a point where it's hard for them to manage all of these, you know, schools with different interests, all these conferences with different interests. But then also they've been dealing with court case after court case that's been sort of chipping away at their influence. And we saw the recent NCAA Alston case. And what you saw there was that the small schools did not want, they had voted on having a stipend, an educational benefit that was capped at a certain amount of money that was a little bit over $5,000. And what you see from that is that the bigger schools wanted more money to be able to be sent to their students. We've all seen, you know, the stories about college athletes who were poor, who did not have the ability to feed themselves outside of going to the dining hall, and, you know, saw their jerseys being sold, and which will take us into the NIL stuff. But we've all heard those stories. And so a lot of the big schools said, well, let's provide more educational benefit. Let's provide, as we call them at this point, are stipends. But the smaller schools couldn't afford that. They didn't want to afford that. So that's why you've seen this change in a lot of the discussion revolving around whether the NCAA even makes sense specifically for football purposes. And so, you know, the NCAA is about in about as difficult a position right now as they've ever been. And that decision, that Alston case, you know, we could see large stipends down the line, and it's not decided. I mean, there is a lot of gray area to what's going on, but that may have also been an influence for the University of Texas and Oklahoma making decisions that they wanted to be with more peer institutions that were making more money, that potentially down the line, if they want to provide a $30,000 stipend to all their student athletes, that they can, and they don't have some schools that are saying, well, that's too much money, we don't want to pay that. So those are all aspects to this thing as we sort of move forward and we see, you know, what's going on. Because at the same time, they want to provide these educational stipends, but they do not want these student athletes to be considered employees.
And there we go. That kind of goes to the next point. Employee, not employee. At the moment, they're not, even with NIL out there, name, image, and likeness. So, Dave, got to ask you first. There's been a lot of questions, a lot of confusion, a lot with NIL, even a month into it and how it's going about. So, first, I will have to ask you, how does it work? Because, look, from my vantage point, it's very messy, and that's mostly due to the NCAA not taking it serious enough until it was too little, too late. Not set rules from state to state, no blanket rules as far as NIL goes. It's basically the wild, wild west out there. And look, I have no issue. I've said it before. No issue with players making money off their name, image, and likeness. But I don't like the lack of clarity in it all. That's not the player's fault here. So there's just a lack of clarity. Month into it now, still so many questions. So, you know, first explain, you know, how does it work? What is it for the state of Florida and their role in it, and how it affects the Gators?
Right. So the name, image, likeness piece is one that we all control typically. Dave, you control your name, image, likeness, your right to publicity, they would call it. And that's something that has been through the generations, has been part of common law and a lot of states that have made those decisions to create statutes that regulate name, image, likeness, right to publicity issues. And so for years, though, the NCAA controlled the name, image, likeness situation in a way where they basically acted like it didn't exist. And so they didn't allow student athletes to do the same things that other students may be able to do. You know, if a student became famous for some reason, they can go advertise, they can go do a spot with somebody, or even host an event that that people have to pay a ticket price to get into. The NCAA banned all those different things, and you know, you saw it really begin to change with there was a court case a few years ago, the O'Bannon case, and that was over the name, image, likeness policies of the NCAA. And so, you know, we of course all saw that one hurt
for us video game fans.
And yeah, so that one did hurt because that video game fans, because all of us who enjoyed playing NCAA football, we lost the ability to play NCAA football because they were creating little mini Emory Jones's little mini
mini Tim Tebow's out there.
Yeah, I mean Tim Tebow's, right? They're creating these images of these athletes while not telling us exactly who the athletes were, right? They didn't put names on them. They just gave you a number, but you knew who they were, right? There was a famous case.
The quarterback
years ago.
Was number 15. He was left-handed. He was 6'5", 6'6", and the size of Tim Tebow. Everything Tim Tebow's biography would have said, that's what he was in NCAA without the name.
Exactly. And the year Tim Tebow graduated and was able to sign an endorsement deal with NCAA, with EA Sports, then he was on the front cover of NCAA the next year after he was done with his eligibility. So it was an interesting system that they had put into place. The O'Bannon case basically not only ended the NCAA's ability to negotiate with EA Sports for all these people who are student athletes who are taking their image and putting it on there, and where that all related back to is a famous case of involving Wheel of Fortune years ago in the early 90s, in which there was a video game. That Vanna White was her image was replicated in that game. And the court said, no, that is her image. You have to pay her for that image. And so that's what happened with the NCAA with NCAA football. But also, for years, right, when I was a kid, I bought a number 7 jersey while Danny Werfel was popular, or bought a, you could buy your number 15 jersey while Tim Tebow was doing his thing on the field at Florida Field, or Rex Grossman. But they weren't getting any money off of that, right? They weren't able to be profitable off that, the actual individual athletes, but the university wouldn't put their name on it. They wouldn't do anything like that because those they were complying with the NCAA rules, but they were still, everybody wanted a number 7 jersey in 1996 or in 2001, wanted their number 8 jersey, or in 2008 wanted their number 15 jersey, and so the schools were able to make money off of it, but not the athletes. And so what we saw was really lawmakers take the next step and pass these laws, both in the state of Florida as well as throughout now. I think it's nearly 25 states that have created these NIL laws, these name, image, likeness, right to publicity, that the NCAA is not allowed to create these rules and stop them from being able to sign endorsement deals. But kind of what you mentioned is right. I mean, it is complete and utter anarchy when it comes to what the regulatory nature of all of this is, because each state's the one that's making decisions at this point, or no one's making decisions at this point. And the NCAA, in trying potentially not to add to their woes when it came to this recent Alston case, just didn't even, they had a working group that went through all the process, decided on all the rules that should be put into place. And the NCAA decided to scrap all that and to say that, well, we'll take our chances and hopefully this decision by the Supreme Court won't be that bad. But we don't want to give them any more ammo to say that we are basically violating antitrust laws. And that's what it all comes back to is there are these antitrust laws. And so that court case actually had nothing to do with NIL itself, had nothing to do with name, image, likeness. Although Justice Kavanaugh did mention the potential for a lawsuit related to name, image, likeness down the road, but it had to do with the educational stipends like we were talking about. But one way or another, it shows that there is a lack of leadership from the NCAA on that side. But now you have different laws in different states. And so the state of Florida's law is different than the state of Georgia's law. The state of Georgia's law is different than the state of Alabama's law. Most of the SEC states have laws at this point, with the exception of Louisiana and Missouri. And so each of those states are going to govern things a little bit differently, and they do govern things a little bit differently. And that's important to understand when some schools are making some decisions and other schools are making other decisions, is that there's nobody really telling them what to do. And that's why you saw Greg Sankey make a statement during SEC Media Days asking, in some ways, pleading with Congress to make decisions and to have some sort of law on a nationwide scale that would preempt all these state laws, because they don't know what to do. And they're kind of operating in the blind, and some schools are going to be more aggressive than other schools. And that's unfortunate, because it does put this level of sort of a wild, wild west mentality to all of this. But in the other ways, you're going to see the opportunity for student athletes to be able to make money and use their name, image, likeness, whether that's with their social media accounts or whether Emory Jones takes off and has a huge year and is you know, on the front cover of Sports Illustrated or on the front cover of ESPN.com. And he can be able to say, well, that's my image now. And it's my likeness and these in my publicity. And so, you know, I'm going to go sign a deal with some company or organization that's going to allow for me to make some money off of all this publicity I'm getting due to my good play on the field. So, you know, it and that could help people stay in school longer. That could help people, you know, make decisions where they're not necessarily going to go to the NFL right off the bat, because they're actually making money. Of course, put food on the table for their parents if they're in a situation like that. So there's a lot of benefits to it. But at this point, there is really zero leadership on a national scale with this NIL situation.
So, you know, how does it help Florida here? And, you know, I'm still kind of waiting for that announcement of this big, you know, this. If you look around the country, there's still yet to be this big company, this big corporation that's really, like, you know, like a Gatorade or a Pepsi or a Coca-Cola or somebody like that who has come out and said they're going to be a part of NIL. I'm still waiting on that. You know, is that something potentially for Florida here? And you brought up something too. How does this affect like ESPN and CBS and all these networks? You know, they use images, they use you know, video of these players and all that. Can and also media, like local media, like myself, when we cover games and all that stuff, can we see players just say, "Hey, ESPN's using my image"? Can they go after ESPN? Can they refuse to do interviews after games now because they're not being paid by us to talk after games? Like, there's so much, you know, murkiness to it all. Of, you know, what is their obligation still to the university as far as their name, image, and likeness goes, and to themselves?
Right. And they do still have an obligation to the university because they are receiving educational benefits from the university. And they are still signing away a certain amount of that to the university and having to comply with university standards, you know, all the way set up to the Board of Governors, say in the state of Florida. And so they're signing away some of their freedom by playing college football. But what this law, especially in the state of Florida, says is that the universities can't restrict them from signing endorsement deals, from signing contracts with an event organizer, say a football camp or something like that, in which somebody with a name that wanted to use it, like in the past, a Tim Tebow, or right now maybe an Emory Jones or somebody like that, could say, or even think about it for volleyball teams or for soccer teams. I mean, they may really want to have the star volleyball player in Gainesville be able to host a camp and be able to train them using that. And so they can make money off those things. Of course, with Instagram and those things have completely changed even in the last 10, 15 years of some people who have massive followers. You think about a guy like a Will Greer years ago with UF.
Yeah.
You know, his brother was a big time YouTube star, Instagram star, Vine, I think, when that was a thing. And, you know, he had a lot of followers. He could have used that to endorse things and do that. But the law really restricts the university from being able to stop their student athletes from signing those deals, as is what the NCAA, still the rules, state they should do. And the NCAA has pretty much abdicated at this point. But it is interesting to say something with recruiting, right? The state of Florida's law specifically states that the universities, that there can't be a contract. The student athlete can't sign a contract that is contingent upon them going to a university, to attend a university. So they can't sign a contract that says, you know, I'm going to do this, get sign this deal for this car company. And as a result, part of that deal is that I go to the University of Florida or to Florida State or to the University of Miami. That's actually prohibited. There's also parts of it, which is why I think that there were some questions about what happened with the University of Miami with that deal that they announced. Yeah. And I don't know how that came about or what happened to end up with the that gym that then ended up sponsoring anybody. But there's language in there that creates a question of whether the university can actually cause an NIL deal to occur. And so there's a lot of questions about the law itself, and it's probably why Dan Mullen sort of questioned whether it was legal that the University of Miami had done that, because it's there's a lot of gray areas in that respect. But that part is not in, say, the state of Georgia's law. And so different laws, different states have decided, in the state of Georgia's law, they have some sort of opportunity for student athletes to share in an agreement with the school potentially. And so there's when you said that we're looking at a situation that is chaotic at best. I mean, that's really where we stand right now, is a very chaotic situation in which there's a lot that we don't know. That's going to have to be figured out. But I will say this, on the enforcement side, there's not much as well that's discussed. I mean, there's discussion in the statute about the Board of Governors regulating some of these things, but you know, there's nothing prohibiting the conferences from regulating it. There's nothing prohibiting other entities from regulating it to a certain point if they were to make those decisions. But there's very little enforcement. You know, there's not, sometimes in statutes, right, you'll see this is illegal, and as a result of this being illegal, if you violate this law, say if you were to violate that law that talks about connecting attendance to one of these NIL deals, that there be that it'd be a misdemeanor or there'd be a fine. But we don't see that in this legislation. So there's a question of what is even enforceable or what that looks like, other than the universities themselves specifically being prohibited from entering into anything that would stop student athletes from being able to make money, and the Board of Governors regulating them to that effect.
Dave, you got time for one more?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Yeah, Title IX is going to be a something very important to go along with this, and the balance of that, but also the employment side of it, and employees, not employees, and issues that come with payments in some form or fashion. So how slippery is the slope? How thin is the line when you're looking at NIL? Because look, right now, as you said, the universities are separate from this. The money is not coming from the universities. It's coming from, you know, mostly businesses out there that are, you know, sponsoring these student athletes out there. So how does Title IX work into this, and how does employment / job come into this, and how slippery of a slope it can be?
Right. You know, that's something that the NCAA and colleges and universities have been trying to make sure is not, does not happen for many years. We saw some movement a few years ago with the National Labor Relations Board on a lower end with Northwestern student athletes, trying to say that there was enough control over the athletes that it was an employment situation. And as an employment attorney, right, we were constantly talking about how much control that an employer would have over over its employees, which would make a determination if they were signing an independent contractor agreement. You can't have as much control as you would if you have an employee, right? So these are kind of fundamental issues that the NCAA has wanted to avoid, and that the schools, of course, want to avoid, because there's so much that goes into employment and that is attached to that at that point. And pro and con for student athletes. The more businesslike it becomes, the more of a professional arrangement that it becomes. You know, a lot of the situations that we see with kids being run out of schools, would that become more of a predominant thing? If you're just an at-will employee, you know, could you just be terminated at that point if you're not producing, rather than getting your four-year scholarship? So these are all considerations that have to kind of come up. But I mean, at the same time, the idea that they're all employees is one that could lead to a really damaging effect on a lot of the non-revenue sports as well. And so I don't see that happening anytime soon. But the more money that gets put into a lot of these arrangements, as you see these educational stipends begin to rise, right? And if they end up being $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and you're getting that as a benefit, you know, the more that you may begin to see some student athletes try to push back on that or attempt to retest those situations. But at this point, the courts have held that they're not employees, and so that's been a thing that at least has provided some stability on that point. But yeah, I mean, if you pay a $30,000 educational stipend to your football players, the question is, do you have to pay that $30,000 educational stipend to a lot of your non-revenue sports? And as it kicks in with Title IX at that point, then the question is whether that's legal if you're not providing that educational stipend to a lot of your women's sports programs at that point, and whether then that's unequal. Those are issues that will probably have to be dealt with in the courts, because football is bringing in nearly all the money. And so at this point, you're seeing football probably bring in 80, 90% of the revenues in some places, basketball bringing in some revenue. And that you know, kicks us back to these grant of rights of television and all that, what that creates, where you're not seeing that. You know, they're not granting rights to your some of your swimming and diving teams at this point, even though the University of Florida has a great swimming team, right? We've right. seen some of the great athletes that have come from that, but there's not the demand television wise to see that at this point. So I mean, hopefully with what you'll see is the NIL aspect of that begin to create opportunities for some of these athletes. You know, if Caleb Dressel was still at the University of Florida, or we saw Bobby Fink do really well winning those two gold medals, they'd be able to, hey, I have some publicity. Let me try to go get an endorsement deal and make some money and have that opportunity. But, you know, these are all the things that are playing into the decisions that all these conferences are making in you know, taking those next steps. And it's also a reason, and I'll also pull this back to, we were talking about, you know, rumors of conferences and the conferences wanting to, you know, sign deals or specifically something like FSU or Clemson leaving the ACC. And they signed a grant of rights deal through 2036. Mm-hmm. From what the reports say in the contract, and again, all this is based on these contracts, is a situation where they've given all their rights to all of their sports revenues to the ACC to hold. And so they would potentially be talking about losing hundreds of millions of dollars if they were to try to leave for a different conference at this point, depending upon what the out clauses say in that contract or how, if a bunch of teams leave, whether that the grant of rights ends, things like that. You know, you could see that potentially being you know, something that could get them out of it. But I mean, you're talking about a big risk on their behalf if they were to try to entertain something like that. And they signed that away for a long time for stability, so the conference would not fall apart after the after Maryland left the ACC. So, you know, they will not make as much money long term here in the next 15 years as will the SEC and the Big Ten and a lot of the conference, maybe the Pac-12, depending upon how things happen, or if the Big Ten were to go raid the Pac-12 and go get a few of their members, you know, that's a situation where it, where, you know, the Big Ten may get even bigger piece of television revenues, but the ACC seems pretty stuck right now. I'll say that. So you have a lot of these things playing into it, though, both on the NIL as well as conference realignment, that we're heading into a phase of college sports that that is uncharted, to say the least. And so folks like me, you know, we're going to be trying to figure out how to manage that for a lot of clients, but then also the institutions themselves making business decisions on how that most makes sense for them and how the, as well they can use NIL to help them. You know, I mean, if one of the questions you asked is how it could benefit, say, a University of Florida NIL. Well, you know, if you got a kid from Jacksonville, right, who's a highly touted athlete from Jacksonville, he may think, you know, if I go to a school like an Ohio State, you know, those in Jacksonville, some of the big time donors, some big time folks who control businesses.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have as much of a vested interest in you doing as well at Ohio State or doing as well at USC. You'd have to hit it pretty big for them maybe to come back, you know, maybe a Derrick Henry type Heisman type campaign, right? That he can come back and has that type of publicity notoriety to get him a deal in Jacksonville. But you know, if you're, you know, we've seen it with Miles Brennan. He has a couple car deals, even though he just hurt his arm, and you have a lot of those things coming into play of the risk that a lot of these companies are taking in signing these deals, and maybe why some of the bigger companies have not gotten involved yet, because there is a lot of risk to college athletes. But for a University of Florida with the name brand that the university has and the alumni network that the University of Florida has, if you're a kid from Jacksonville, if you're a kid from Lakeland, if you're a kid from Fort Myers, if you're a kid from Seminole County or from Pasco County, right? There's a lot of Gator fans that are in a lot of these big metro areas in Tampa, Orlando, even down into West Palm Beach and Miami. And you may have more opportunity without having to necessarily perform the same level on the field to be sort of a hometown hero and be able to get some of these deals easier than it would be if you were going out of state or going to, you know, an Ohio State or going to a Michigan or going to a Notre Dame or some of these schools where they just don't have the same vested interest and there's not as many folks that are rooting for you on a day-to-day basis in your community. And so that may be a big opportunity to keep some kids in state. And I know that's, you know, been an issue with recruiting is keeping kids in state for all the Florida schools. So there may be an opportunity for Florida schools to use that and say, hey, be a big deal at the University of Florida, and likely you'll have an opportunity to make a lot more money in one of these large metro areas like a Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, that you wouldn't have otherwise. And to be honest, there aren't that many large metro areas in a place like Alabama or Louisiana in comparison to the state of Florida, right? So, I mean, the state of Florida as currently the third largest state in the country, you got a lot of large areas with large media markets that don't exist in a lot of other states. And so that could be an advantage, but we're going to have to kind of figure it out as we go. And you're going to see a lot of uncertainty kind of moving forward, unless there is something from Congress that really creates a regulatory system across the board for all of these schools. And you see there's been several bills that have been filed and discussed. One of them is from Marco Rubio here in the state of Florida. I know that Representative Gonzalez in Ohio has also had a bill that he's filed that has gotten some traction. He's actually a former student athlete at Ohio State playing football. And so you see the potential that there could be something coming from Congress, but as we well know right now, that's Congress is not necessarily functioning at its peak. So I wouldn't hold your breath for anything that is going to happen on the national level thus far. But hopefully we'll see some sort of, as all this stuff begins to settle down, we'll see some sort of norms that are sort of put into place, and there'll be more of a situation where schools can begin to find a sense of normalcy, and then the student athletes can be able to know their limits and be able also to make some money off of it.
Sounds good. They meant a whole lot of info right there. As I said, there were so many questions, a lot of murkiness that goes on with both these topics that we discussed with conference expansion, especially the NIL side of it as well. Still more questions than answers through a month of what we're seeing with NIL. So thank you for kind of weeding through both of these topics and helping our listeners out there right before football season starts, before the real stuff starts, the two hot button summer topics. One last look at those before the game of football starts. So,
yeah, and hopefully, Dave
show, man. So thank you.
Well, I'll say is hopefully that all this realignment, all those aspects of things, they'll calm down a little bit here over the next few months until next off season. Everybody can enjoy some football, and it's going to be an exciting season and looking forward to it. And I'll be cheering on the Gators in the Swamp most of the games this year. So looking forward to being there in person again and enjoying what makes this sport so special in college football, which is the pageantry and the tradition that goes along with it. That's really unrivaled in American sports and is a reason to keep all this and to the benefit of both our student athletes and to some of our great universities. So, yeah, I was happy to be here. Love the show, and we'll be watching throughout the season.
Sounds good, man. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for being a loyal listener and agreeing to hop on here on Gators Breakdown. That's Dave Chauncey, education, labor, employment lawyer for Alexander DeGantz Barnett Legal right here in Jacksonville. Dave, man, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm David Waters, host of Gators Breakdown. You can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Guys and girls out there, thanks for listening to this episode of Gators Breakdown.